What Adrian V thus was not an Italian. And the Roman people were so disgusted with his brief pontificate of a little over a year that they never since that time have elected anyone pope except an Italian. Before that, there had been Greeks, there had been one Englishman, there had been many Frenchmen, there had been people of many different nationalities who had been pope. But from 1524 to the present, every single man elected pope has been an Italian. They had one Spanish, one from Spain in the Netherlands, born in the Netherlands, and head of the church in Spain, whom, after a few months of him, they had enough of foreigners as pope. Well, Adrian only lived for about a year before he died. There were rumors he'd been poisoned. But somebody put flowers on the door of his physician, where showing their joy that he was dead. And the general attitude in Rome was great happiness when they were rid of Adrian. But during these few months of Adrian's activity, he set to work to reform the church and to get rid of Luther. And so he sent a representative up to Germany to the Diet. I guess we'd better leave that till number 5, the Diet at Nuremberg. Number 5, the Diet at Nuremberg. Nuremberg, the Diet met in different towns, different times, as I think is obvious by this time. The next Diet, the one at Nuremberg, was not anywhere near as important as the one at Worms. The reason being, Emperor Charles was not there. The emperor sent his brother, the young Archduke Ferdinand. But Charles was busy trying to defend himself against the King of France and trying to defend his property in Italy against the King of France. It took some years to fight off the attacks of the King of France. Eventually, he defeated him in a great battle and took the King of France captive and took him to Spain, where they held him for some months until a tremendous ransom was paid for him. So that eventually he was rid for the time being of France as an adversary that was trying to tear down his power. But while he had France to deal with, it wasn't easy to get the opportunity to really settle the Lutheran matter. So the Diet at Nuremberg had to meet without the emperor present. But his brother was there to preside. And Duke George was very much there. And Duke George was complaining about the fact that this outlaw, Luther, was not only permitted still to live, but was actively, publicly preaching and was sending out writings. And in fact, printing, let us say, printing had now been known for maybe 60 years. But during the next 5 years, there were probably more books printed than in the previous 60. And of the books that were, the copies that were printed, perhaps half were by Luther. So Luther did a tremendous amount for the increase of printing. And printing did a tremendous amount for making the Reformation able to have a widespread in Europe. But Duke George made these complaints, but the dukes and the officials in the Diet, most of them weren't too much concerned about it. They thought very, very highly of Elector Frederick. And they did feel the Pope had been taking altogether too much money out of Germany and had been very restrictive against Germany in many ways. The King of France felt the same way as regards France, but he simply made edicts, taking half of it and keeping it himself, and saying the Pope couldn't appoint anybody to a bishopric in France unless he approved, and taking actions like this while not interfering with the doctrine of the Church at all. The German organization being much less unified, it couldn't be handled in quite that way. But the legate now who came representing the Pope, his representative at this time, came with a letter from the Pope. And the Pope said, "We have sinned. We have been corrupt in root and branch, from the Pope down to the lowest priest. There have been wickedness, there has been corruption, there has been sin. We are going to remedy all this. We are going to put an end to all abuses. We are going to thoroughly reform the church. But before we set about doing this, we want you to seize this pestiferous fellow Luther and send him bound down to Rome so that we can give him the treatment he so richly deserves. And the Duke said, well, he said, these are a lot of words. He said, you show us some real reform before you begin to talk about what you want us to do. And Luther took the Pope's letter and had it printed and distributed. He said, why do I need to point out the corruption in the church? Here's the Pope himself telling us. And so the letter became a strong force in spreading the knowledge of the need of a reformation. Well, I didn't bother you with subheads under five. George's complaints, the Pope's letter, and the attitude of the Diet. But as you see, the Diet of Nuremberg didn't make any real change in anything. And so for the time being, while the emperor was so tied up with trying to fight off the attacks of the King of France, there wasn't much that could be done to stop Luther's, the spread of Luther's teachings. And Luther's figure, either the France and the emperor will make peace one of these times, may come very suddenly, who knows. The Pope was praying for peace so that the emperor would be free to turn his forces against Luther. They'll either make peace very soon, it'll be over, or maybe the emperor will defeat the King of France. But whatever happens, the emperor has a big force ready to turn against me. And the minute it happens, I'll be seized and burned. So that's what he, for some years now, kept constantly expecting would happen, but meantime, he kept working. And so number six, the spread of Lutheran's teaching. Spread of Luther's teaching. First of these, small a publication. I've already mentioned about the various types of publications which he got out. He got out very scholarly works, answering objections and attacks. He got out popular works for the people as a whole. And some of these popular works were very cleverly gotten out, would have done honor to an advertising executive of today. He, for instance, on the title pages of his book, he had one which showed Christ standing at the door of a house representing his church, inviting the people to enter by the door, but with popes, cardinals, and monks climbing the wall to get entrance in a clandestine fashion. In another book called Triumph of Truth, the common folk of a German town were represented singing songs of welcome to honor an approaching procession. Moses, the patriarchs, the prophets, and the apostles carrying on their shoulders the Ark of the Holy Scripture. Hutton, one of the knights who had espoused Luther's cause, came riding on his war horse. And to the tail of the horse was attached a chain which enclosed a crowd of ecclesiastics, an archbishop with his mitre fallen off, the pope with his tiara in the act of tumbling and his pontifical staff broken, after them cardinals, then monks, figured with the heads of cats, pigs, calves, and so on. Then there was a triumphal car drawn by four living creatures who represent the four evangelists, and on one of which rode an angel. Karlstadt stood upright in front of the car, Luther stride alongside. In the car, Jesus sat, saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Holy martyrs followed, singing songs of praise. Perhaps the most important work of the kind was a book called The Passional of Christ and Antichrist. This book, Luther planned. Lucas Cranach designed the picture. And it's interesting, Lucas Cranach was one of the most noted artists of the day. He's not one of the great artists of the world, but he's a good artist. Good enough that his pictures of Luther and of Luther's wife are, I believe it's in the Vatican, it's in one of the great galleries of Italy where they have his pictures of Luther and his wife. And you'll find his pictures in the galleries of Europe. Not one of the great artists, but a fairly good artist. But Lucas Cranach designed the pictures, and Melanchthon furnished texts from Scripture. They had a series of engravings in them. representing the lives of the Lord and of the Pope, so arranged that whenever the book opened, two contrasted pictures could be seen facing each other. Like they showed Jesus washing the disciples' feet, opposite it, the Pope holding out his toe to be kissed. They showed Jesus healing the wounded and the sick, the Pope presiding at a tournament. And you know, at the beginning of the Second Vatican Council, at the first day, I believe they took 8 hours while the cardinals and I think 80 cardinals and most of the archbishops and representatives of all the orders came up one after another to bow before the Pope, and certain of them kissed his foot, certain higher ones kissed his hand, but the bulk of them kissed his foot there. That was just at the beginning of the recent council. This has been a regular procedure. And in the St. Peter's Church in Rome, there's a statue of St. Peter, which when I visited Rome in 1912, the big toe on the statue had been, half of it disappeared from being kissed. All who came in usually stopped and kissed this toe of St. Peter's statue. Now, I believe they have it covered over with glass or something, so you can't kiss the toe anymore. There wouldn't be any toe left if they do something about it. They showed one picture, Jesus healing the wounded and the sick. Opposite it, the Pope presiding at a tournament. One picture, Jesus bending under his cross. Opposite it, the Pope carried in state on men's shoulders. One picture, Jesus driving the money changers out of the temple. Opposite it, the Pope and his servants turning a church into a market for indulgences and sitting surrounded with strong boxes and piles of corn. Piles of coins. Luther said it was a good book for the laity. Well, he published many types of books. He took John Huss's writings and republished them. He also took the writings of Dominican friars of 200 years before. A book by a Dominican friar called Tauler he republished under the title The German Theology. Luther did not think he was discovering something new. Luther was taking the teaching of the gospel, which had been held all through the years, but which in the Middle Ages had become confined to little groups here and there, in various monasteries or little private groups studying the Word of God, but the superstitions had gradually developed, and in the attitude of the leaders of the church had to a great extent overcome them. Yes, Mr. Yes, the title, as I had it, was in Latin, and I tried just to make a rough translation. But as given here, it is P-A-S-S-I-O-N-A-L. Passionale Christi, C-H-R-I-S-T-I. Et, Latin for an, Antichristi, Antichrist, the Latin, of Christ and of Antichrist. These publications then had a great influence in Italy. Various cardinals and other leaders, even before this time, had organized the Oratory of Sacred Love, which met to study the gospel and to study Luther's writings. And while Leo was still Pope, one of the scholars in the Vatican has said to Leo, he said, Luther is simply following the teachers of St. Paul. You'll have to get Paul's books out of the Bible if you're going to resist Luther. And another, though, of the great scholars of the Vatican, seeing one of the cardinals studying the New Testament, said, you shouldn't read that. That'll ruin your Greek style. That's a barbaric Greek style, that book is. But there were these two tendencies, the humanistic tendencies, they call it the lovers of the classics, and on the other hand, the real influence towards the gospel was felt in Rome, in Spain, in all over Europe, where Luther's works were being read. In England, I've already mentioned that at the universities there were groups of students whom they called the Germans, because they would meet and eat together and read Luther's works. And so his books were being widely spread. And in England, the King of England set to work to destroy it, and ordered that the Luther's works be destroyed, and they had a great bonfire in London, at which his works were destroyed, and King Henry VIII of England taking Luther's book, The Babylonian Captivity of the Church, wrote an answer to it, which he had written in Latin and was covered with gold covers and picked up in wonderful, beautiful condition, and sent to Pope Leo X as a present, attacking Luther, going right down the line, attacking his Babylonian Captivity of the Church, and in gratitude for it, Leo X bestowed upon King Henry VIII the title Defender of the Faith, a title which is to this day printed after the name of the rulers of England. They use the title Defender of the Faith, as every king has since that time, which was given at this time by Leo X to the King of England, Henry VIII. Now that's A, B, converts. Small B, converts. We have mentioned Philip of Hethi. And Philip of Hethi was a young man, not yet 20, but he was in control in Hethi, and he was an active man, and when he decided something was right, he went all out for it. And he was one of the greatest supporters and helps of the Reformation, and at one time became almost its greatest danger, which we'll look at later. But he was a very energetic man, and I believe a man who sincerely loved the Reformation and its teaching, but who never succeeded in escaping from the evil effects of the upbringing of a young man from a ducal family who had almost absolute power over the people immediately around him. So that his career is mixed, and we'll refer to him many times later on. Then the small C, imperial city. Now the empire was a very mixed sort of a thing. It included duchies and it included areas, many different areas ruled by local officials, but it included quite a large number of cities which had won their freedom somewhere in the course of the century. And these cities owed allegiance to no one but the emperor. One of these cities was the city of Magdeburg in North Germany. That was the city where Albert had first become archbishop. Of course, as a result of the negotiations for the indulgence sale, Albert had become the Archbishop of Mainz, which was a greater archbishopric for the south, and he usually lived there. But in Magdeburg, one day in 1524, in May 624, a poor weaver took his stand near the statue of one of the emperors and sang two of Luther's hymns. From thee great need I cry to you, and may God be gracious to us, while people crowded around him on the morning of May 6, 1524. The Bürgermeister, coming from early mass, heard him and ordered him in prison. But the crowd rescued him, and they raised up enough of a commotion to make the Reformation established in Magdeburg. And many cities, there were events like this, so that all over Germany, different sections began to turn to the Reformation. We'll continue there next Tuesday, but first, of course, have our written lesson tomorrow morning. And please be sure to sit in your book 12. Now, in book 12, which is entitled The French, book 12, The French, and in that, it is only 7 chapters this time. I want you to get the material rather well in it. It is the first 7 chapters. Now, you'll find a fair amount about the political events, about France's first defeat and his being taken as a prisoner to Spain and so on. We're not greatly interested in that. Just read that. That enlarges a little your understanding of what we say in class about that. But what he says about characters in the religious life of France, like Lefebvre, Bertin, Brissonnet, and those others, you'll find their names in any character that he tells much about in that, of a religious nature, the sister of the king, so on. Those I want you to know about for sure. And turn in by next Friday noon a brief statement about each character, each religious character mentioned in these 7 chapters. Yes? This coming Friday. Yes. This coming Friday. See, this is only 7 chapters. I've been giving really double assignments so far, once a week. Now, this is one of the two assignments. The next one, though, won't be due until next year's of Dobine, Book 12. Turn this in by this Friday noon, and to be turned in. Not a great deal to be turned in, but the facts to be remembered about these people, which are rather important. Now, this will cover 14 chapters in this book, in which there are 15 chapters. The 15th is about the early life of Calvin. I'm not assigning that at present, because we will take him up separately later on. But these first 14 deal with events contemporary with what we're now discussing in Germany, and I want you to see what was happening in France at the same time, without our having to take much time in class. Now, Mr. Smith, we were speaking last time about, which number were we in? Was it F? F6C, very good. The spread of Luther's teachings was 6, and C, I was mentioning the imperial city. And I mentioned Magdeburg, this great city in North Germany, Magdeburg, where the weaver began to sing this hymn that Luther had written. From great need we cry to you, O Christ, and to these other hymns, and the mayor coming from Mass ordered he be arrested, but the people gathered around and prevented him from being interfered with. And by a spontaneous popular uprising, the situation was completely changed, and Magdeburg became a thoroughly Protestant city. And there wasn't quite as dramatic as that in most of the other cities, but the bulk of the so-called free cities of the empire turned over to Luther's teaching at this time. One after another. His teaching spread rapidly through Germany, through what is now Austria, and had a great influence in many other countries. We'll say more about that later. We want to mention the small d, just briefly, the controversies that Luther was in now. I'll just mention here two particular ones, and then another one we'll take a whole main heading on. These two were with Duke George. Duke George, you all know, the Duke of Saxony, cousin of the Elector Frederick, who was very much aware of corruption in the church and anxious it be reformed, but very much opposed to any change in its doctrine. And he was bitterly opposed to Luther. And he and Luther had quite a controversy by correspondence after Luther came back to Wittenberg. George appealed to the Diet to cause that Luther should be seized, but the Diet did not do anything about it as yet. And then Henry VIII of England had written a book on the Seven Sacraments, which was a book attacking Luther's writing on the Babylonian captivity of the church. And a copy of this with golden covers was sent to Pope Leo, and Leo gave him the title Defender of the Faith. And Luther wrote a very, very scurrilous attack on Henry VIII, which he later greatly regretted. But he wrote in very strong language and published the letter which he sent to his ungracious king, King Heinz, by the ungrace of God, King of England. And it was a very terribly strong controversial attack. And later, when Henry VIII began to swing toward the Reformation, Luther wrote him and said that he knew that Henry wasn't responsible for the book. It was one of his bad advisors who'd written it. And that didn't make Henry feel any better, because Henry was rather proud of his work. So here was a case where Luther may have won people who were already with him to feel more strongly with him, but it made it harder to get a friendly attitude on the part of King Henry later on. Well, now capital G, the Peasants' War. The Peasants' War, 1524 to 25. When Luther had been in the Wartburg, some of these men who had come to Wittenberg and began stirring people up had begun attacking anything in the setup of the day that seemed to them to be unjust or wrong, and began telling the people who were less well off that they should take what other people had and should put themselves in a better situation. And some of these men, after they left Wittenberg, after Luther's preaching on order and looking to God's word at every step before making changes, some of these people who left went to other places and began preaching uprising and complete change in the whole social order. People varied tremendously. Some of these men had quite a bit of evangelical teaching with a little bit of emphasis on this sort of thing. Others, this was the main thing, and their evangelical teaching that they had was comparatively little. But many people naturally thought the whole thing was a result of Luther's work and Luther's attitude. As a matter of fact, practically every century during the Middle Ages, there had been a peasant uprising. 150 years before that, there was a tremendous peasant uprising in England. In most of the countries of Europe, there had been these peasant uprisings. Because the conditions of life were so poor during the whole Middle Ages, that the great bulk of the people lived on the land where they had to struggle and scrape in order to get a bare subsistence, and a small part of what they produced was seized by the great lord, who lived in considerable luxury. But if you took everything the lord had and divided it up among the peasants, they wouldn't all have been more than 5% better off probably than they were. But comparing their miserable lot with the wealth and luxury of the great lord, naturally they felt very much, some of them came at times to feel very much disturbed and upset about it. And actually what they needed was improvement in production, improvement in means of making more for everybody. But the emphasis was not on that aspect in those days. And life continued for many centuries in a situation where the bulk of the people lived in a very difficult situation. And the great lords, most of whom had their position simply because they were their ancestors had been such, and not because of any special ability that they had, although they were trained in fighting much better than the peasants, of course, and some of them were well educated, trained in other ways. In their families, there was a tendency to look down on the peasants, and this resulted in a good deal of brutality and mistreatment in many areas in Europe. And Luther felt great sympathy for the peasants, and he wrote exhorting the lord to treat the peasants better and to show Christian attitude towards them. And some of these agitators took some of Luther's statements and quoted them and used them in their efforts to arouse insurrection among the peasants. Well, now, this sort of insurrection had occurred practically every century during the Middle Ages in most of the countries of Europe. And as I say, actually, if the peasants killed off all the lords and all the leading officials and took everything they had, they probably wouldn't have been more than 5% better off, each of them. It was not the means that would actually improve the situation. That came when people began to get better methods of production, which was largely still a couple of centuries off at this time. But Luther wrote urging the lords to treat the peasants better, and people like Philip of Hesse who were anxious to live in accordance with the gospel, always treated their peasants better than most of the lords did, and probably were influenced by Luther's writing to treat them still better. While in other cases, people said, oh, this fellow Luther, he's attacking the church, and now he's attacking the established order. And when there would seem to be any sign of an insurrection, they would blame it all onto Luther. Well, at any rate, in 1524-25 occurred one of these great movements
of which I say there were great many at different periods, usually about once a century. Usually they ended with terrible bloodshed and with the peasants being worse off than they were before. But this one, happening to come just at the beginning of the Reformation, I don't think the Reformation had much to do with bringing it on. It may be that it had hastened it slightly, I don't know. But at any rate, it was to some extent blamed on Luther. I mentioned number one there, Luther's attitude toward the peasants' troubles. Now, number two, the rise and fall of the rebellion. If we had 3 years on this course instead of 1 year, I would perhaps take a couple of weeks describing the details of it, because they did affect the Reformation in the end in various ways. But as it is, we will barely refer to the fact that agitation was spreading through Germany, and it had this difference, though, from communist agitation, for instance, of today, that there was no organized, highly trained group that was trying to get a changeover in which they could get control. There was nothing of that kind. There were individuals, some of them very radical, who were trying to provoke an insurrection and who seemed to maybe were hoping they themselves would get into great power and control, but there was no organized, carefully worked out system such as we face today with the communist movement in all over the world. And consequently, the rise seemed rather spontaneous, but occurred in many parts of Germany, and particularly in South Germany. There was the wooden shoes that the peasants often wore. The habit had come that holding up the wooden shoe was sort of like a flag, like a call for insurrection. And they waved the wooden shoe, as they called it, the wooden shoe, which was the sign of standing together against the Lord. And these groups of peasants, expecting that they were going to change the whole social structure and introduce equality for all and greatly improve conditions, began gathering together and attacking the people that had possession. Now, Philip of Hesse had such a movement start in his territory, and he immediately went and met them and talked to them. And they pointed out to him certain ways in which some of his men, some of his officials, had been unfair or had seemed unfair, and he immediately promised to remedy those, and they knew sufficient of his character and attitude that they had confidence in him, and the uprising didn't last a week in his case, and there was no real trouble at all. It quieted right down in his territory more than perhaps in any other section of Germany where it got underway. Frederick the Wise was ill at the time. One of the examination papers spoke of him as having died in 1520. I mentioned how Luther had written some articles to comfort him in his illness, but he did recover from that illness. It wasn't until about 1525 that he died. But he didn't have a great deal of trouble in his territory, though more than Philip of Hesse had. But in some of the regions, the uprising was very severe and went to great lengths, and great numbers of innocent people were killed in the uprising. And then the knights and the nobles gathered their forces and attacked, and the peasants who were not trained for war and who didn't have armor and equipment like the lords have were rather speedily overcome, and it was put down in the end with great cruelty, and great numbers of the people were slaughtered. Now, number three, Luther's declaration. Luther certainly did not bring on the peasant revolt, and Luther's attitude toward the peasants' war is rather typical, in a way, of Luther's life. That is to say, Luther did not say, how can I improve the church? How ought the church to be? Let's make a blueprint. Let's try to make this blueprint effective. Luther found salvation in peace in his heart through the Lord Jesus Christ in the monastery. He found
understanding from studying the Bible, which he found in the monastery library. And he found what he needed, and then he went on following that which meant so much to him. And as one by one other issues came up, he faced them in the light of the Scripture and immediately did what seemed to him in the light of the Scripture to be the right thing to do at that time. But he had not the time, nor was he the type of man to sit down and try to make a whole new world or a whole new theology. He dealt with each issue as it came up and studied it by itself. And so in the end, if you take all of Luther's writings together, you get a very sane, well-balanced theology. There is really comparatively very little difference between the teachings of Luther and of Calvin. In fact, on the point which people speak of as Calvinism, you have to find Luther much stronger than Calvin on those particular points, most of them. But on the theology as a whole, there's very little difference. But Luther, you have to take all his works together to get this, because he deals with issues as they arise. And he studies an issue and deals strongly with this issue, and it may be inconsistent with something he said before. But then when that comes up, he deals with that. Well, Luther was interested in God's relation to the world, especially God's relation to man, not particularly interested in trying to improve social conditions or to make any change in political conditions. To him, that was very secondary and comparatively very uninteresting. But as matters of that type came to the fore, and it was seemed to him right or necessary to take a stand, he took the stand on the immediate issue without relation to its effect to other things. And the result is that there are those who think that Luther's declarations in connection with the Peasant War were very inconsistent. And there are those who blame him for them, when actually I think it is due to not understanding what he was doing and what his attitude was. Luther's declarations may seem to contradict each other, but actually they don't. They represent a very strong statement of his relation to a particular feature as it came up. Well, now, let's just speak of what his declarations were, which seemed inconsistent to some people and which greatly disappointed them. First, of course, he had his exhortations to the nobles to show a kindly attitude towards the peasants and to improve things that could be improved. And wherever you have people together, you have things like this. Wherever you have people, you have misunderstanding, you have brusqueness, you have unkindness. And a Christian must be looking for mistakes he's made and seeking to remedy them and to avoid that sort of thing. And Luther's parents, his ancestors, had been peasants. He knew from hard experience what the misery of a peasant's life was. And Luther, in the course of his religious exhortations, had been appealing to people who were better off to be kindly toward those who were worse off and to make their lot better just as far as they could. But Luther never had any idea of leading to an insurrection or an uprising or an attempt forcibly to change the whole established order. Some of these preachers, though, these agitators, would quote a sentence here and there from Luther and make people think that what they were doing was what Luther urged, which it wasn't at all. Then, however, when the peasant uprising began to show itself in rioting and upheaval and in destruction of buildings and killing of innocent people and that sort of thing, Luther spoke out now against that in very, very strong language. He said that order and peace, was proper, and that brutality of this sort was absolutely wrong and should not be tolerated anywhere in the world, and that the forces of the law should put it down with absolutely ruthlessly. And he spoke in the strongest language on this, and some of the non-Christian nobles took
some of his statements as giving them license to treat the peasants in a way that Luther never dreamed of before. But his language, he always was a man of very strong language. And some of the language he used about the thieving, murderous peasants who were leading these destructive forays of attacks upon other people's lives and property, some of that language was very strong and turned many of the people who might have been interested in Luther's teachings, but who were primarily interested in social improvement, turned them against him permanently. But then after it was put down, then Luther wrote appeals to the nobles, he was then appalled with the way they treated the peasants, and with the terrible cruelty shown towards many of them, and the great numbers who were executed, and he wrote appeals to the nobles to show a Christian attitude toward these whom they had overcome, and to recognize that many of them were innocent in the whole affair, and had been aroused by agitation, or had been just placed in a position where they were forced to take sides, one side or the other. He even wrote to Archbishop Albert, who was about to hang one of the peasants whose father Luther knew, and this man represented that his son had been innocent in the affair, just caught in it. And he wrote Albert a very humble letter pleading with him to show mercy to this man. He wrote letters like this, trying to do what he could to alleviate the suffering of the peasants who had now been so completely overcome. Somebody said, if you want to stand neutral between opposing forces, you're apt to make enemies of all of them. And often that's the case. I've been in situations myself where there have been two forces opposing each other, and I saw mistakes. One made a mistake, the other, and I tried to be friendly with both of them and to show each of them where their error was, and in the end, neither one of them had any use for me. And whereas I could have made perhaps a lifelong friend of one and a lifelong enemy of the other. But I don't think our object in life should be to gain human support, but to do what the Lord will it. And I think the Lord will it to stand for what is right, regardless of its effect on particular human beings. But Luther did this, and many writers think that the progress of the Reformation was greatly hampered by Luther's attitude in the peasant war. I'm not at all sure myself that it was. I think in the way he showed his courage with his willingness to speak out on either side when he saw abuses on the other, and his standing for what he considered were right principles, even though these principles seemed to put him at sometimes on one side and at sometimes on the other side. He really wasn't taking either side, but he was attacking what he considered wrong and pleading for justice and kindness and fair dealing on everybody's part. Well, the peasant war is something that people often discuss at great detail in connection with the Reformation, and actually, I think very frequently they forget the fact that it was one of a series of such movements that came about once a century in practically every country of Europe, and probably would have taken pretty near the same course as it did if Luther hadn't been there at all. Except that perhaps there would have been more bloodshed and more cruelty on all sides if it were not for the alleviating effect of some of his declarations. But now we go on to capital H, Luther's marriage. And the Catholic Encyclopedia says that you can see the callousness of the man Luther, that while in South Germany, the people were in misery and dying as a result of the peasants' revolt, Luther gave himself up to the pleasures of connubial bliss up in North Germany where he lived. Well, carry that on logically, it means nobody should marry whenever any war is going. And it is typical of the sort of attacks that used to be made on Luther in Roman Catholic writings, picking anything in his character at all in order to attack it. There's a very interesting set on Luther, seven volumes, I believe, by a Jesuit named Greisar, G-R-I-S-A-R. And Greisar, writing in German, wrote the seven volumes on a very careful study of Luther about 40 years ago. And to my mind, you could take these seven volumes and pick out about a third of the material and make one of the greatest eulogies of Luther you'd ever find. He takes up practically every statement about Luther and examines it very carefully, into all the details he can get, and he's very fair in most of his treatments. And he, for instance, takes up the allegation that Luther started the whole Reformation because he wanted to get married, which has been widely circulated through the last few centuries. And then he takes it up and shows how the evidence on it shows that this was not the fact at all. And then the allegation Luther was a drunkard. And he shows that Luther often had difficulty sleeping at night, and he might drink a glass of beer to help to get some sleep, but that was about the extent of his indulgence in alcoholic beverages. And he takes up many different attacks upon Luther and goes into them at great length, examining all the evidence available. But he also brings all the various charges that have been made against him. It's a very thorough work. The translation of it into English, which the Knights of Columbus put in the University of Pennsylvania Library. And I really wondered how it would advance the Knights of Columbus cause, putting this particular set there. But I guess Reicher was attacked for his defense of Luther in the book, because within the last 10 years, one volume Life of Luther came out by Reicher. And in this one volume, he's taken all of the critical things he said about Luther in the 7 volumes and put them together. So the one volume is a very, very critical attack upon Luther's life and character. And most of what it says are things that are true, as there's no man who ever lived but who made mistakes and has faults. But if you take his 7-volume set, you would find that the general impression you get is quite different. One place in this set, I remember, he even made this statement. He said, in view of these facts that I brought out, why is it that so many books have repeated these various stories and things about Luther? Well, he said the reason is because for 3 centuries, Roman Catholic writers, even Jesuits, he said, were forbidden to read Luther's writings or to read any Protestant books. So he said all they could do in writing on Luther was to read the attacks made on him and repeat what they read. But of course, he was going right to sources and getting all the original evidence. And on the whole, he speaks very favorably of him as a man. The tendency in the last 10 years, I think, perhaps the last 5, is to try to show the mistakes of the Romans in dealing with Luther and to represent that actually they shouldn't have lost him if they'd handled him rightly, and that really he was a great man to look at his good features. But 20 years ago, that would have been practically anathema on any Roman Catholic group. But H.S. Luther's marriage, and number one is his attitude. And Luther had expressed repeatedly the declaration that he was not going to marry. He expressed this repeatedly, and the reason was that he did not expect to live long. It was his expectation he would be seized and burned at the stake one of these days. And if it were not for the attack of Francis of France, King Francis I, against the emperor, it would seem that surely Charles would have done it. In fact, many of Luther's friends thought that Luther would be killed at the Diet of Worms. He thought there was a big chance of it himself. And Charles, when he was on his deathbed, the Emperor Charles looked back to the time when he had Luther right in his clutches there and said, oh, why didn't I kill him when I had him right there? Could have done it so easily. But that's not typical of Charles's attitude. Charles was suffering terribly from gout at the time. He had his confessors who were trying to make him think over everything in his life that he should confess before death, and he took a very extreme attitude then, which was not characteristic of him. Charles was, on the whole, a man of very considerable high character. He had mistakes in what he believed in, but he conscientiously tried to advance what he favored. And he favored a church in which there would be a certain amount of freedom of thought, and the Pope would simply be the executive officer. And he had given his honorable word that Luther would be allowed safely to return home, and he stood by it. Although he did, in the next few years, begin to persecute the Protestants very severely, particularly in the Netherlands. A great many there were burned at the stake on his orders. But Luther would have been killed if it had not been for, in the providence of God, particular conditions which protected him and which you never had any guarantee would last more than another year. George of Saxony was just over the border to the north. In fact, it's a wonder that George didn't organize his troops and just make a sudden foray south a few miles and seize Luther, which probably there were many times when it could have happened. But it didn't happen. And so Luther actually lived until 1546. I want you all to remember that date. We're not really giving it yet. We'll come to it later. But he lived until 1546 and was very active all those years. What his attitude was, he felt that vows of celibacy were wrong. He was convinced from the scripture that marriage was the normal life, and he felt that the monks and the nuns should leave the monastery, should marry, and should live wholesome Christian lives, but he did not expect to do that himself. He wanted to devote his life entirely to the presentation of the gospel and not to have anyone, woman, tied to the misery of seeing him killed, which he thought would come very soon. But number two, Catherine von Bora, we've already told about how when Luther was taking care of these nuns who couldn't go to their homes because their homes were in Duke George's territory, how Luther tried to find husbands for them and did make many matches. And when he tried to arrange a match for Catherine, she turned down everybody he tried to arrange it. Yes. B-O-R-A, capital B-O-R-A, Catherine von Bora. He tried to arrange and she turned them all down, and Luther said, well, who would you be willing to marry then? Well, she said, she named one of the preachers there, I'd be willing to marry him, she says, or you, Dr. Luther. And Luther wrote to somebody and he says, they won't, he says, they're not going to fasten any wife onto me. And it took quite a while before she broke down his resistance. But number three, his sudden marriage. Some of his friends were shocked by the fact that quite suddenly he had married Catherine von Bora. And somebody said to Luther, well, what'd you do this for? Oh, he said, I did it to please my father, to vex the devil and spite the Pope. And he was always clever in his little remarks like that. But he did marry her rather suddenly. They had the marriage ceremony, and then they had a larger ceremony a little later. And to this, some friends were invited, and Albert of Mainz, hearing of it, sent a purse of gold as a wedding gift to Luther. Disgusted Luther, Albert having been the man to whom all the indulgence business started in the first place there. And Luther wanted to send it back, but Catherine was a very frugal soul and she insisted on keeping it. Some of his friends were disturbed about the suddenness of his marriage, and Erasmus said, here we thought this was going to be a tragedy, and it turns out off, after all, to be a comedy and ends in a marriage. And that's typical Erasmus's light way of looking at just about everything. King Henry VIII says that shows you the insincerity of these people who claim they're out to reform the church, and actually all they're looking for is physical pleasure in getting married. Now, Henry VIII himself married six times, so he had more. But to Henry, it was a most wicked thing that a man who'd been a monk should marry. Now, number three then was his sudden marriage. Number four, his married life. Catherine von Bora was not an especially attractive woman. She was not particularly good looking, but a woman of very good general common sense. And she had been put in the nunnery when she was quite young and been given a fair education. That is much better than the average woman would have in those days. Not highly educated by any means. But she proved to be a good manager, a good housekeeper, And she made him a very happy home. And Luther, they had quite a number of children. And Luther was really devoted to her, though he playfully referred to her in his letters as my Lord Kate. And he promised her a certain amount, a certain prize or something, if she would read the whole New Testament through, which she immediately set to work to do. But one day during the Peasants' Revolt, when things looked very, very black and looked as if the forces that were gathered to put down the peasants would one of these days, since the peasants were out of the way, come and attack Wittenberg and take it. And Luther was very discouraged, and he was going around just absolutely, absolutely so discouraged he could hardly speak cordially to anybody. One morning he came into breakfast, and in came his wife, all dressed in black, black from head to foot. He says, "Why, Kate?" He says, "Who died?" "Why," she says, "God's dead." So he says, "What do you mean, God's dead? What a blasphemy thing to say." "Well," she said, "I figured he must be, the way you go moping around all the time, feeling so sad." And Luther immediately saw the point and cheered up and said, "Well, the Lord has everything in his hands, and though it looks utterly black to us, we know that his purposes are best." And thus, she was a great help to him in taking his teachings and making them living and real to him often, and helping him. And his marriage was a very happy one. Now, capital J then, political events from 1525 to 1529. Number one, accession of Clement VII. Accession of Clement VII. Well, maybe I should have told about his accession before. You can't get things strictly chronological. But he was the Pope during these years, and he didn't enter into our history in any striking way before. I did mention before the death of Adrian, the Reformed Pope, who was the only Pope for a few months before he died, and the Romans had put put flowers on the door of his doctor's home when he died. They were so glad to be rid of this reforming pope. Well, the cardinals had enough of reforming popes after Adrian, and so they elected Clement VII, the cousin of Leo X. And Clement VII had been the administrator, pretty much, of the papacy, while his cousin, Leo, had been the pope. And they thought, well, we'll have another one like Leo, and that's what they wanted. So they elected Clement VII. And he was about as poor a choice as you could make for a church which was facing the crises of the Reformation and needed a strong hand who would reform the church and get rid of the abuses that everybody recognized were abuses. And if the church were to be unchanged, would at least make a very strong, clear stand against Luther. Clement did not have his cousin Leo's attractiveness, his attractive qualities, but had all his love of pleasure and of life, and probably no more real interest in religion than Leo had.